We're here to discuss the proposed social statement of the Lutheran Church in America called Peace in Politics. But I thought the first thing for us to do is to have some idea of what the statement actually says before we start discussing it. So the way to do that, because all of you have studied the statement completely, is I wrote a summary of it. I read it over and it takes 5 minutes to read, so if you're I'll read this, and I'm doing this, I'm going to read this now without comment or without any of my opinions included in there. So first of all, it might be helpful, what is a social statement of the church? It is not doctrine, meaning this is not like a statement that is made that will become like the official doctrine of the Lutheran Church in America. But a social statement of the church is really, it's voted on by the church in convention, and this document will be voted on next summer when the LCA convenes in Toronto, Canada. And then it becomes really a way that the convention both speaks to the church and also the way the convention on behalf of the church speaks to the world. And when I say on behalf of the church, of course it doesn't mean it represents the opinion of everybody in the church, but if whatever the convention does approve, it certainly represents the opinion of that convention, and these delegates are elected to represent the church. So is that clear now, what a social statement is? Here's a 5-minute summary. First of all, the first part of it is the occasion of this statement. Because of weapons of mass destruction, peace has become a necessity. As Christians, the gospel calls us to work in the political system for a just and peaceful world. In baptism, we are given the peace of Christ in order that we may work for the temporal peace. And the statement really builds itself around those two, the peace of Christ and temporal peace, and I'll explain later what those are. Then it has theological affirmations, which are these. Sin is the root of war. Sin causes us to make distinctions and also to step out of our creature role into domination. And then war is a result of this sinfulness. And it also, the statement also says, it is God's punishment on human sinfulness. And no war can be called righteous. Now, temporal peace, and here now it gives a definition of temporal peace. And to really understand the statement, you have to have this definition down. Temporal peace is a daily work of human government to cultivate civility, secure justice, and restrain violence. This is what now the paper calls temporal peace. It's a daily work of human government to cultivate civility, secure justice, and restrain violence. Through government, now God works for the preservation of humankind. And that word also is very important in the document. The government, God works through the government for the preservation of humankind. Both police and military are needed for this, which is God's work of preservation. And God calls Christians to work in these functions. However, a Christian in these functions may disobey as a last resort. Okay, when the temporal peace breaks down, we have war. And the untiring pursuit of this temporal peace is the work of the Christian. Okay, then the document shows how we share the Western heritage of the just war tradition. And then I'm not going to say what the just war tradition is, but the statement does spell it out. This tradition shares this with pacifists. The use of lethal force in war is incompatible with Christian conscience. However, the just war says there may be exceptions. Nor the just war tells what these exceptions may be. The just war criteria provides a means to discuss the moral justifiability of war. And the statement uses an example that there is an argument among just war people on either nuclear weapons, even their possession, is unjustifiable, or possibly what they call cleaner weapons may be justifiable. Cleaner weapons. Okay, then the peace of Christ, now it's very important to get this. The statement says the peace of Christ is the heart that is set to do God's will. And it's really, as I see the paper, it's an inner peace that is given to each individual. It's also the inner forgiveness. And this inner peace of Christ then empowers the Christian to work in the temporal realm for temporal peace. And then a quote from the statement, established by the one who governs without might, the peace of Christ inside the person, that's my addition, enables us to participate in the governance of might. This includes working to control and reduce nuclear arsenals. The cross of Jesus is that which keeps us from utopian dreams as we work for temporal peace. I could point out here is the only place in the document that the cross of Christ is used, and it is that which keeps us from utopian dreams. Then the statement goes on to list both judgments and tasks that Christians make and Christians do. First, it states the arms race is being challenged, and the arms race is a risk. Superpowers should find new ways to deter each other and other ways to compete. Christians should be part of the debate, and they should debate with both boldness and modesty. The good versus evil mentality and the crusader mentality should be rejected, or is rejected. Also, isolationism and unilateralism are both rejected. Also, there is a warning that if we reduce nuclear weapons, we might have to pay more money for conventional weapons. We should support negotiations for arms reduction with a verifiable freeze as a goal. The superpowers should carry on dialogue. Linkage is rejected. Now, listen to this one. Deterrence is approved as an interim stage. Therefore, participation in the system, even in the manufacturing of nuclear weapons, can be done by a Christian with a clear conscience. This is the task of peacekeeping. We should not ignore the task also of peacemaking, and we should be concerned about tensions outside of what is called the superpower conflict. The document condemns the international arms race, which fuels non-nuclear wars, and then also deplores the tendency of East and West to fight through other wars in the poor regions. Reminds us that temporal peace requires justice. And then the church affirms both those who work in the government and who work in the peace movements, and reminds those who work in the peace movements that they should do so as part of their care for God's creation. Then the conclusion, we are to cooperate with God to preserve creation until God brings it to an end. In other words, before it ends, our stewardship is to preserve it. And then we do this out of our gratitude to Christ. And then the document closes then with some enabling resolutions, mainly like a call for us to study this document, engage in political responsibility, advice to pastors on preaching, to seminaries and other schools, far as developing educational programs. Now, this document is presently being reviewed by selected congregations that will add their input, and then it will be presented to the convention next summer to vote on.
Do you have an extra of those?
Does anybody have an extra copy of that?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now, part of the input into the process is for when groups meet like this is that the group send in a report on what is discussed that is fed into the process. So does anyone like to take notes? Anybody enjoy that?
I like the realism that he didn't say that he likes to, but he...
That's realism. Now, the first thing might be, are there any questions about what the proposal said? And then I think I'd like to call on opinions and both affirmations and criticisms of this report that could be helpful in the process. First of all, is the document clear? Are there any...
On paragraph 3.11 on page 18, you in your summary stated that unilateralism is not acceptable.
Mm-hmm.
I thought there was a little bit of tension in this paragraph. We must also criticize the supposition that That's the wrong one.
3.10 is for unilateralism.
Yes. Unilateralism as opposed to careful, calculated unilateral initiatives while having dramatic appeals inherently destabilizing. So apparently, careful, calculated unilateral initiatives are acceptable.
Yeah. Yes. In other words, to try to initiate peace process, which is bilateral.
Right. Okay.
So that's, I think, consistent.
Okay.
Yeah.
On 234, I just had a question mark. You'd have to explain it a little bit. The cause of Christ is a decisive move to attempt to achieve utopia in the present world, whether in the form of a crowning technological advancement or the return to untrammeled nature. I don't honestly understand what that's saying. I mean, I thought the no was a typo and it should have been yes. But I evidently don't understand.
Does anybody want to try to clarify that?
Read the whole thing.
Yeah, it's the one place where the cross of Christ is used in the...
It's a decisive no, in quotes, to the attempt to achieve utopia in the present world, whether in the form of a crowning technological achievement or of a return to the untrammeled nature, to untrammeled nature.
Well, I know the theology behind that. I'm not sure. It's the theology of a fallen name, that we belong to a fallen order. In other words, it affirms original sin as an inevitable condition that we live in as humans.
In other words, the cross of Christ is a judgment on any attempt we have to reach perfection.
Or it wouldn't have been necessitated. There could have been another way to salvation, mm-hmm. namely by human achievement.
Okay. The ideal would be to read this paragraph by paragraph all the way through, but time is really limiting. We have an hour, so are there any other just points of clarification before? Then I'd like to call on anyone who wants to just start to either analyze the kind of whole emphasis of the thing or certain points. Anybody want to start? If there's no more, I'm not assuming that it's totally clarified, but that we have enough of an idea that we can move on.
I asked a question regarding procedure. If you want to go ad seriatim, or just wherever we had questions to direct our attention to them and skip around.
What about that as a group? Should we just skip around, or do you want to just start on the first page and move?
I'd like to do some general reactions.
Sure. Why don't we do that? Just let's share some just general reactions to the whole statement, and then I think I would say then just anyone that wants to refer to a special paragraph then, but what about some general?
Dean, could you just point me to the paragraph where they discuss deterrence as a, in terms of a moral mm-hmm. issue? I just wanted to read it.
Okay, it's 318. It says, deterrence is an interim stage leading to the control or reduction of nuclear arms. Christians, therefore, may participate in good conscience in the system of nuclear weapons, whether as policymakers, administrators, military personnel, or manufacturers. The church should affirm these members as participating in the work of peacekeeping.
Does that suggest that escalation is an appropriate, in order to have an adequate deterrence, escalation can be argued quite readily?
Sure.
Seems to me that that's a conclusion that could be drawn by those who support escalation. And I would therefore think we need some rewriting at this point.
I do too. There is, I think, an internal inconsistency here. It speaks of indefinite, will be for an indefinite time to come, which intrinsically gives me all kinds of problems. To accept that as an inevitability, not just for the immediate future, indefinite to me, it's awfully strong.
It's an interim of indefinite time.
Yeah, that's right. And isn't that a contradiction? Because then it goes on, we accept the policy of deterrence only as an interim stage. Unless my understanding of those two words is wrong, they contradict each other. Mm-hmm. And I certainly would want to go with interim if one is going to suggest deterrence as a policy at all, and I think I would, with very bad conscience, however. And certainly not opt for that maximal phrase of indefinite.
It also seems that we are willing to accept the policy of deterrence because it's politically expedient or necessary and has actually very little to do with the gospel. It seems to me it wouldn't hurt to point that out, that it's certainly not a very faithful thing to do to threaten to murder anyone.
Yeah, and that does raise the question of another phrase there. When you then come to people involved in nuclear systems, manufacturing, etc., Christians therefore may participate in good conscience in the system of nuclear weapons. Mm-hmm. I think Luther would even disagree with that with the two kingdoms. When you are dealing in that other kingdom, I don't think you do it in good conscience, do you? Isn't that too strong?
Well, to me it takes any ambiguity away from it.
I think so.
It seems to me that the there's the contradiction in the particular spot in the text that we've already mentioned, and then I think that is absolutely on target in terms of it doesn't seem to have much to do with the gospel, and in between that sort of intermediate, taking up the what appears to be the point of view of the document itself, namely this occasional reference to realism or what's realistic, yeah. Which is a word that crops up again and again and is sort of given always favorable preference to what it's contrasted with, namely ideology of fanaticism. It seems to me that you could make the argument, just occupying the ground that the people do in the document, that the passage that we're looking at on page 20 is highly unrealistic because it suggests that deterrence can be accepted as an interim leading to reduction of nuclear weapons, whereas the historical record is quite clear, and that is that ever since deterrence has been conceived, it's led to the escalation of nuclear weapons. So that, I mean, if you're going to be realistic in the way that these people apparently want everyone to be realistic, it seems to me that they look like the ideologues. That is, they look like they're kind of inflexibly wedded to an idea of deterrence, even though the historical record that they themselves want us to invoke suggests that deterrence has been an interim, all right, but an interim toward escalation and increasing armament, not toward decreasing one. So that would be a kind of internal criticism on the ground that these people
And I could add just a little bit to that, that if that in fact is the policy into the indefinite future, then with every year, the likelihood of their being used increases.
Precisely.
So you have an incredibly destabilizing factor there, which again runs contrary to their overall emphasis on this being the realistic and
right.
sober approach.
Right.
On the top of page 14, it says, it enables Christians to assume responsibility for nuclear arsenals in working to control and reduce them. It says nothing about eliminating them. As I read this, I can't see how my being a Christian would make any difference in the way that I now live and accept the government's policies. And on the top of page 11, that to call justifiable war a responsible expression of neighbor love, I think you have to call it what it is. It's not an expression of neighbor love.
Dan, while Mary is pointing to that one, it shouldn't be overlooked that what we're looking at on page 20, Christians therefore may participate in good conscience in the system of nuclear weapons, has a virtual contradiction on page 10, and it ends with the thing that Mary just pointed out. 22, within the Christian community, both just war thinkers and pacifists have shared a common presumption that the use of lethal force in war is incompatible with Christian conscience. Mm-hmm. And then it goes on to say how they differ. And then later on it says, in good Christian conscience, one can go on making the weapons.
But it's the underlying use. You know, that was one of, in the bishop's statement, that was one of the real strong debates. Use versus use. Does that paragraph have to do with use?
Well, this is lethal force in war. It is use. But one ought to at least to point out to them that you've got to say more about good conscience in producing weapons and bad conscience in using them.
Yeah.
And you can't just let it rest right there.
Yeah. But that's where the nuclear weapon builder in my parish rests his position. That it's not going to be used.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, he can maintain it.
Yeah.
That's what. Now, I don't agree with that.
Yeah, because one thing is, I think is noticeably absent is any sense that there are principalities and powers in this world that are out of control in this issue. I just get the feeling all the way through that we're fairly well in control.
Yeah. I wish I knew names, and maybe we could, as people talk, at least give their name, because I'd like to address the people by name. The person behind you, the woman.
Mary.
Mary.
Mary. Was that Mary?
Yeah.
That's Mary.
Oh, you're
no,
kind of in the dark there. Mary. I'd like to take
your
up
name.
On
your who?
Your I'm Paul Hansen.
Yeah.
I'd like to take up on what Mary raised on page 14 top. Because I think that, what she found is quite alarming there continues throughout that page. On 235, I find both a misconception and a presupposition which I can't accept. Maybe I should read it. Everyone doesn't have a copy, apparently, here. The dream of a perpetual peace based upon the calculation of eliminating nuclear weapons is based on the illusion that the historic developments which produce nuclear weapons can somehow be undone. Now, I think the misconception there is that everything that humans invent is intended by God. Obviously, nuclear energy is intended by God because it's there. But that should be converted into weapons, into tools of destruction, as intended by God, I think is as unconscionable as saying that a butter knife was intended to be used to stab someone in a murder.
Amen.
Mm-hmm. So I think that is just very naive and unjustifiable. And then the presupposition is also unacceptable. You could paraphrase it. The presupposition is that the historical developments which produce nuclear weapons cannot be undone. Once something has been introduced by humanity, it is there forever. Now, I think it's not inaccurate to observe that poison gas, mustard gases and things like that, used in a wholesale fashion in World War I, because of international law, were not reapplied in World War II. Hitler had the opportunity and was tempted and decided not to, even when things were getting very desperate. So I think there's precedent for weapons which have proven to be so lethal to all sides and to civilians that they simply have been removed from the market. And that then would be precedence for saying that it may be undone if it's appalling enough.
Well, read the rest of that paragraph.
Indeed, the elevation of nuclear weapons to such preeminence that temporal peace is thought to depend upon their elimination is to erect an image of world peace based upon devotion to and fear of such. I don't follow that logic.
I don't understand.
It doesn't make any sense.
You know, see, if something gets terrible enough, it becomes your god or something. That whole paragraph defies my understanding.
To think that even Hitler, who did all that he did, refused to use the nerve gas.
Yeah, and you know one of the reasons was he experienced
it. What does that say about us?
Yeah, he experienced it in World War I, and I suppose he realized that it was too dangerous to get into. Of course, the analogy is good because you can't control nerve gas. The wind changes, and we had that happen to us in World War I. And, you know, it is such a close analogy that
it seems to me to be treacherous rhetoric in the sense that it is, as you say, and others have seconded the idea, incomprehensible, but aimed presumably at an audience which holds this odd position. I mean, in other words, it seems to me to be addressed at what is envisioned as an audience. And notice how odd the audience is. They begin by dreaming, but by the fifth word, they're calculating.
Yeah.
They dream of perpetual peace, but they base their dream upon a calculation of eliminating nuclear weapons, but that's in turn based upon an illusion. So these people to whom they're talking just don't have any coherent view of the world at all. So they're aiming it at a group that doesn't exist.
Yeah. Could we call this just an un-Christian, really unbiblical fatalism?
I think that's right.
Mm-hmm.
I think 36,
Dr. Brown
seems to me it has a lot to do with original sin, though. It seems to me it makes a lot of sense. It doesn't, this paragraph doesn't bother me that much at all.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's hear that, because original sin is something that's part of Christian realism we have to deal with.
I think the only thing that the writers of this particular paragraph were trying to say, although perhaps I'm sure there is a lot of other stuff in here to debate, but I think their general concern is that those of us who are involved in the peace movement, we don't become too confident in our efforts producing prolonged world peace, because in fact we can't turn back the clock, whether we like it or not. Even though our society might choose not to use nuclear weapons, the fact is that another society could quite as easily garner that knowledge and produce it. I think all they're asking for here, or the warning, is that those of us involved in the peace movement not become too confident in our efforts producing a prolonged world peace. And they're doing so out of perhaps maybe a preoccupation with original sin, but nonetheless, I think at this point a healthy one. And Niebuhr would get up and jump up and down at this point, I think, you know, in terms of the 30s and the era of a positive pacifism in terms of world peace and international cooperation. And then watching it fall apart on the shores of World War II. But I think that's essentially the gist of what they're trying to say here, although I agree with the fact that it's addressed to a kind of a nebulous audience. But at the same time, I think I grasp what they're trying to get across. I don't agree with the last two sentences.
I'd rather if they said it the way you just said it.
Let's see, there's one here and then here. Yeah.
Change this, and you probably want to get back at that, but I want to bring up this paragraph 310 on unilateralism, and it seems to me anybody who ever talks to it, just the use of that word, no matter who is using it, is almost suggesting a kind of a suicidal step, you know, if you're unilaterally, the end is the end. But I want to get a little clarification from some of you who have been following this more closely. Not too long ago, if memory serves me right, Kissinger said something in a very guarded way about saying that maybe it is time for us
to take some kind of risks and making some kind of unilateral step. Now, and I can't quite recall, and I was wondering, some of you who have been closer to that can recall specifically when you...
That'd be the unilateral initiative, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
In that matter?
Yeah.
I think so.
Yeah.
At least they affirm that.
Yeah. Even though,
I think unilateralism with the ism means a total removal of all...
The statement says calculated unilateral initiatives is inherently destabilizing.
It's really it's set up in a negative way.
You read that wrong.
We ought to know.
Unilateralism in opposition to calculated unilateral initiatives is inherently destabilizing. So not calculated unilateral initiatives is destabilizing.
The first sentence puts unilateral measures down.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. It starts out putting them down, saying unilateral, no.
Yeah.
I think we can sort of save this paragraph in terms of its at least internal logical consistency. I think unilateralism refers to the basic policy of this country during the 30s in the aftermath of the First World War, when we said basically, or there were a lot of people saying, look, we ought systematically to be the authors of our own geopolitical future. That is, no entangling alliances, no memberships in groups for collective security. We simply have our own interests, we simply follow them, and we don't get involved with other countries. But that's a systematic, right, as across the board matter of policy on everything. A unilateral initiative here and there, calculated, isn't necessarily to commit yourself to unilateralism across the board. That is,
I think you're confusing two terms, Mark. That's isolationism.
Well, yeah,
I mean, I'm against unilateralism in this sense myself, but I do think we have to keep those two separate. Unilateralism here, in a document dealing with a specific issue, I think is specific and means unilateralism in dismantling our whole nuclear arsenal. Am I right or wrong on that? I think there's some semantic clarity here.
Well,
I don't think it means isolationism, all of the 30s.
I thought it was said within this whole context of how we couldn't afford to retreat into kind of an enclave and not take any responsibilities for global...
Well, I don't see that. I think it's more specific.
There's one other paragraph that refers to isolationism.
Okay, so you're saying that you think that this would be then against, say, a unilateral freeze on our part?
It certainly is that, yes, specifically that, and not isolationism diplomatically.
So that could be, in other words, to be concrete, to declare tomorrow that this government will stop now the building, maintenance, production of all nuclear weapons would be, according to this paragraph, unwise.
That's right.
I think unilateralism even means eliminating what we have. I mean, it's never defined. That's another problem with this damn document.
Yeah.
But
your confusion is right at the very beginning. Because the call for unilateral measures is not a synonym for unilateralism. And so you don't know. And then they go on to affirm the possibility of unilateral initiatives. Mm-hmm. And it's one thing to warn against the call for unilateralism, but then you shouldn't say unilateral measures, because that's an inclusive term. Inclusive of might be interpreted as inclusive of unilateral initiative. That's just poor language.
Raise your hand.
Oh, I was just going to say, back to the 235, he was saying that tear gas and everything wasn't used again after World War One, and he was saying that maybe this generation won't use nuclear weapons, but the next might. Which I think is true with the tear gas too. The older generation now knows what that's like, but like, I don't know what that's like. And maybe people say, hey, you know, it worked in World War One, so why not try it again? Which is what I'm afraid of will happen with nuclear weapons.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, good point. I'd like to raise two issues. So C.I. respond that really came out to me in this article. One is how you feel about a statement of the church mentioning, unless I'm exaggerating here, I see nothing in this document mentioning anything that Jesus says about the way of peace, or the way of peacemaking.
Yeah.
So that's one issue. The other issue, I don't see any ecclesiology, meaning anything the church and community does for peacemaking,
the peace of Christ seems throughout to be something that happens in the individual heart, and then the Christian then works in government. And there isn't any sense that I see in it of anything unique that the church does other than what individual Christians do in society. Third is the question of the eschatology. You might say that the theme of it seems to be that God is going to end the whole world, but in the meantime, we're at least supposed to preserve as much of the world and human life as we can. It's like this group who wrote this seemed to have missed the last 30 years of scholarship, where we've really moved into a theology of hope and an anticipatory community of God's future shalom. Did anybody that wrote this listen to the last years of scholarship? And
Larry? Can I just pick up on that? Because there is an attempt to articulate Christology here, and I think it's precisely at that point it goes wrong.
Mm-hmm.
It's on page 13, it's 231. The peace of Christ is hidden from the eyes of this world, the gift of one who emptied himself of power and authority, and it goes on, and then the last line of the consequence for the church, then, or Christians, established by one who governs without might, the Prince of Christ enables us to participate in the governance of might, and that ends, then, the next page, and enables Christians to assume responsibility for our nuclear arsenals and working to control and reduce them. I think the turn there is to see in Jesus one who emptied of himself power and authority, that rather than seeing an alternative form of power,
right,
and, exactly, and a different shape of exercising power on the part of those who cluster around Jesus. In other words, it's the wrong Christology, which then, having stated that, doesn't give you an ecclesiology of an alternative way of exercising power and calling forth authority, because it rings true. That's where I think the turn is made.
I've always understood the whole gospel is God's way of power.
Yeah.
You know, how did they... Mary, did you...
Yeah, on paragraph 3-4, page 16, your first point about not saying anything about Jesus, I think we could take off on the first sentence, although we have no special authority as a church to advocate particular policies, I think there is a divine disarmament plan, and it's very much... We have the authority of Scripture as to how Jesus wants us to behave and live. And I just don't understand when they say, although we have no special authority. Because I think it does have particular things in mind to be reconciled as peacemakers, to love your enemies, for one thing, which is never mentioned in this document.
Anybody else that hasn't spoken yet?
To me, Dan, that's the critical theological point in the document, is the failure of the Christology to understand the politics of Jesus having anything to say to the politics of the present, and then the failure of understanding an ecclesiology that's an expression of that understanding of the politics of Jesus.
Does everybody understand how using Christology and ecclesiology and Larry, give it another.
Pardon the lapse into seminary jargon. Back to 231. Rather than seeing Jesus in the language here exercising his lordship through servanthood in the way in which these people do, namely that is divesting one of power and authority, that's the way this reads. That's how Jesus is present among us. Rather than seeing it that way, I think we ought to say, Jesus exercises power and authority, but it has a particular shape to it. It is the nonviolent way of the cross. That's not getting rid of power. That's a particular way of being powerful in the world. And the way they read it is that because Jesus emptied himself of exercising power, therefore Christians are free to go ahead and exercise power. And then you end up on the next page saying, therefore, responsible Christians are involved in the way in which the world goes about exercising power, making arms, etc.
Larry, you know, you put your finger right on it, but I think we have to also recognize where this theology is coming from. And it's deeply rooted in Luther, or especially post-Luther orthodoxy. And it is really popular today again, you know, in people like Martin Hingle and Heiko Obermann. And what it's eschatology is precisely what you have found here. You know, that comes in the end here too, until God ends the world. We're stewards, where does it say in the conclusion, in the preservation of the creation until the time when God has chosen to bring it to an end. Luther, according to Obermann, has a high eschatology. He assumes the world is ending, perhaps in his lifetime, and hence the Christian message is message of salvation out of this world. And it is for that reason that the governance of the world is simply consigned to the princes. And that's why Heiko says he just simply gives that realm up. And it seems to me that's precisely what's occurring here. Since you have that imminent end, and since we as Christians are called to be citizens of this other kingdom, we as Christians at the same time, insofar as we participate in that other kingdom, have freedom to do what we will with power and to manage it as well as we can, aside from Christian principles, because they apply only to the eschatological kingdom. I think that is a theology that is the one consistent leitmotif that runs throughout this document. And so I think we have to take it on, if we're going to, on that fundamental theological level, and ask whether that's Lutheran, or if it's Lutheran, whether it's Christian.
Well, that explains, I think it's right that we've identified you and Larry have identified the crucial passage in the document as to where things take an odd turn. But then the document does kind of make a kind of internal quote-unquote sense, because you begin to wonder as you read on, well, now all these things are being recommended like unilateralism, and there's nothing. Let me see if I can remember the Sermon on the Mount. Is there anything there about avoiding entangling alliances? No. There's all sorts of things, though, about what the form of power is that we should undertake as Christians. And so you get the paradox in this document. None of that is in, and what is in isn't anywhere in the New Testament for the most part. That is unilateralism, to take one example. I mean, you have to really be exegetically astonishing to get unilateralism out of the New Testament, it seems to me, whereas following the way of the cross, the way of power that you were just discussing, is right there everywhere, and yet that's not in the document. And that, I think, turn, as you elaborated on it, does explain, at least, for those who are baffled like I was, as to why nothing of the gospel is in, and what's in isn't in the gospel, is the shape the document takes.
Thought I had related to that. It's fascinating to me, the church that claims to be sola scriptura bases this on seemingly almost all on natural theology. Well, we now have to go to the Roman Catholics to see somebody that's taking scripture seriously in relating to the war peace issue. Thought of mine.
I'd like to go back to the unilateral, since you mentioned that, paragraph 310. I find it very interesting that they really don't, in this chapter, in this paragraph, mention, again, tie it in with the gospel, particularly the last sentence, to advocate unilateralism as a basis of policy would, in addition, effectively remove the church and Christians as serious participants in the policy debate. I don't see, there's no argument for that, that's just presented. I would see no inconsistency at all if, for example, the Reagan administration did implement, as they are planning to do now, the MX missile system, and another administration a little further on decided that that was too much and that the Soviet Union was viewing that as threatening and unilaterally scrapped it. I don't see how there is an inconsistency there. I guess what I see is I think they are using unilateralism in this paragraph as isolationism. I don't think that unilateralism necessarily has to be absolute unilateralism, which means that we will just totally tear apart our nuclear arsenal. I don't think that. I think that what they are saying instead is isolationism, which would enable you to believe that you could do that and not suffer any consequences practically, is wrong. But I see no inconsistency with the gospel and unilateral actions if we decide theologically or pragmatically that unilateralism will increase the security of the world.
May I point out another thing that is connected? The next paragraph, 311, criticizes the supposition that a de-emphasis on nuclear weapons in national security policy can be had cheaply. So it seems to suggest that anyone who adopts that posture has, namely, not an emphasis on peace, but emphasis on escalation. And now we throw in another argument for that by saying that the alternative to nuclear, reliance on nuclear, is higher, more expensive methods of deterrence. I don't think that that's necessarily the case, especially in a case where all of the economies of the world that are developing nuclear weapons are suffering from it. It seems that the result of bilateral reduction will be a lightening of the financial burdening of these countries, not an increasing of it. Is there a presupposition there which also may be fallacious in your mind?
Yeah, it's scary to me. It's a paragraph of despair.
Yeah.
As I see it.
Now, we are hearing, I think, from some very persuasive people that a problem in our economy is this nuclear arms buildup. And indeed, it is enervating our social welfare system. This seems to argue, for those that would argue, just the opposite case.
Mm-hmm. But the thing that next, isn't it unbelievably discouraging to hear them say so casually in 312, we support policies which create time and space for the ongoing negotiation of differences and the displacement of international rivalries. From the military,
yeah.
To good news, now we can have rivalries,
yeah,
about politics, economics, and social questions.
Yeah,
as though it's a great step forward if we have economic rivalries. I mean, this is practically, it's horrifying, really.
Yeah. I want to put my hand up. There's one hand here that hasn't spoken yet, and then we have 5 minutes. And in that last 5 minutes, I'd like to say, is there an opinion that's emerging just out of this group that we could have some consensus on? Maybe not, but I'll give it a try. So
yeah,
you could speak, and then if I could do that, I'd be glad.
I introduce myself. I'm new here. Peter is my name, from Washington, D.C.
Hi, Peter.
I live 4 blocks from the White House, so I'm pretty close. I'm not sure if there is a paragraph on imagery here. I don't think so. I would like to see call of the church to consider the image of the enemy, because this is something I happen to encounter permanently. This is this irrational fear the Russians are so. And I would like to have the church statement calling upon the leaders or upon the politicians to consider images as a Christian way of peacemaking.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's so important.
Thanks. Any ideas of just a word that we felt here the last 50 minutes or something?
I think the Christology thing, I think that we should make a statement deploring the fact that the greatest force for peace that we as Christians know is left out of account. Instead, there is an assumption here that current trends leading, perhaps, almost in all likelihood, to a nuclear holocaust are considered inevitable, rather than seeing the force of the gospel giving us a basis for hope that those trends can be reversed. Mm-hmm. You know, that the gospel does impact the culture within which that gospel is taken seriously. Well, I can't accept this division between that world, which is secular, and this world, which is our personal faith.
Seems to me that's a fairly... Well, it just seems like it's a constant product of the collapsing of the dialectic between original sin and redemption. Lutherans constantly collapse the dialectic back onto original sin, and therefore redemption has no redeeming characteristics at all. And in fact, what Jesus had to say on the cross was nothing, had nothing to do with power and authority. He left that all up to us because we're doomed to original sin. I think essentially that's what has to go on here, is a major criticism of the theology behind it. And when you do that, you're taking on the entire, you know, theological infrastructure of the church, which is
then another
a long discussion.
We're not calling for a change of some of the paragraphs here, but we're calling for a... What does Ephesians mean when the book of Ephesians says Christ is our peace between us?
Yeah. Yeah. Or the whole ministry of reconciliation with Paul in 2 Corinthians.
And very very ambiguous use of the word authority. I don't think they're really clarifying what they mean by authority. Mm-hmm. So Jesus had no authority. Yeah. People were overwhelmed by the way he spoke with authority. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's as though we're trying to write within the context of civil authority when we do believe we have an authority.